I am Ken.
And I'm Olivia.
And this is Antiques Freaks. Dee is tragically out of studio for the moment, but hopefully back soon. In the meantime, we have Olivia here to tell us about oddities.
Oddities. The reason why I can't tell the difference between cherry and oak, but can still call myself an antique freak.
What am oddities?
Ooh, good question. And it's hard to answer.
Uh-oh.
I also wanted to give Dee enough space to discuss, like, individual aspects of oddities, like the bloodletting episode from a couple of weeks ago would have technically been covered under oddities, so I don't want to, like, I had to delete two screeds that I went on in my notes about scientific glass. So I'm trying to stay, like, pretty bare bones about this definition. So the bare bones definition of oddities is medical or scientific antiques and specimens.
Really?
And that's it.
I have been applying this term all too loosely.
But that's okay, because the history of science is really confusing and covers a lot of different stuff. Like, a lot of occult is science that got disproven. Palmistry was a legitimate field of science for many years.
Oh.
The art of reading a palm was considered to be, like, a really good way of seeing the general health of a person.
I mean...
Right, they're not wrong. It is a good, like, especially if you are, like, a European who feels like taking off a patient's clothing is too much, even if for a doctor.
It's icky.
It's icky, because you gotta keep the clothing on to prevent from sin.
They're all naked under there, don't you know?
Yeah, you can't have that. So, okay, one of my notes is basically history is a giant game of telephone, and it's true. I stand by that note. We have recorded history. Recorded history was done by eyewitnesses. Eyewitnesses had their own agendas. So sometimes eyewitnesses can have contradictory reports or leave stuff out. There is this existing account of a man who was in one of the pharaoh's retinues who ran away. He ran really far. He went from Egypt to probably Palestine.
Oh, shit. Quick jaunt.
Yeah, just a quick jaunt. And he had, like, he built his whole life there and didn't write down why.
So he put himself in the witness protection program of ancient Egypt.
Yes.
And just fucked off without telling anybody, like, reasons?
Right. So we have to extrapolate. And we know that there was, like, probably a coup around that time.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So he was like, I'm part of the pharaoh's retinue and he's dead. And his brother's on the throne instead. I gotta get the fuck out of Dodge.
Time to get out of Dodge.
Yeah. That was a tangent. I'm sorry. This is why you can't have me on podcasts.
If there's one thing we hate on Antiques Freaks, it's tangents.
But, so, okay, I said all of that because, like, the history of science is the history of humans trying to figure out their world and having absolutely no frame of reference. Like, people were writing down things as if they were describing them to aliens because they either didn't have samples or they didn't know what the fuck they were looking at. So, like, Marco Polo's description of a rhinoceros is a great example.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and there are a lot of other examples of people, like, traveling great distances and being like, it has a snake on its face, but it's wrinkly and big ears. Four legs. And nobody really knew how to describe an elephant until people drew them repeatedly.
I mean, I can't blame them. I can hardly describe an elephant now.
Exactly. It's five blind men in a room trying to tell what an elephant is. But we do have records of medical treatments that are, like, they would write these things down, and if something worked, then they kept it, and if things didn't work, then they threw it away. Again, before science, we had religion. Before universities, we also had religion. Before institutions of science that we know of them today, we still had this compulsive need to record things and prove to others that this was the best way of using them. So a lot of our records of treatments are full of prayers and herbal remedies because the herbal remedies work and the prayers are because the herbal remedies are still made out of herbs. We might as well pray. And this all basically comes back to samples. I'm bringing all of this up because oddities is the practice of collecting things that can't fit into any other antique category. So, like, I said that it's all science and medical stuff. Does that include maritime antiques? Because a lot of that is measuring and trade tools. But a lot of people would say no. The same thing is true for mercantile antiques. Before we had standardized methods of selling and packaging things, people would use weights and scales and other things that could be considered scientific equipment and might have also been sold alongside scientific equipment. Does that count? No. And that's because you can have a specialty in these industries and not give a shit about oddities or medical antiques or anything else. So, like, it's kind of the leftovers of the antique industry. When people leave things because it's too weird, oddities people are, like, sick and they take it. You know, this person is really into this glassblower's factory, but they don't want the prosthetic eyes because prosthetic eyes are gross. So you take the prosthetic eyes and you say, $50 each, they're oddities.
Give them to me.
Exactly.
Sorry, I'm still reeling from, like, what if maritime antiques were oddities? And it's just, like, my favorite Venn diagram, where I can sit precisely in the center.
Exactly. You're, like, the whale's teeth. Do whale's teeth count as maritime antiques, or do they count as oddities? Kind of both.
Oh, man.
Kind of both. Starfish, like, antique samples that somebody put together, wrapped up into jars, they shipped them to a museum, now they're falling apart. Which ones are they? Are they maritime antiques, or are they oddities? I would argue they're oddities.
Dang.
What would you say, my maritime archaeology friend?
I guess it depends on whether or not if I showed it to a summertime Nantucket tourist, they would lean in interestedly or recoil in horror.
Right, and that's fair. And that's one of the, like, and a lot of it is aesthetics. But, I mean, that's why we're having this whole conversation about definitions, is that it is difficult, a little bit difficult to define. When I was working at the store, we had a lot of people who would come in and be like, I have my grandmother's dishes, and that doesn't belong at an oddities store. But at the same time, my boss did bring in dishes from a Masonic hall. And that counts, and I would argue that Masonic stuff and, like, secret fraternity stuff counts because it's antiquated science. Like, we don't think of it that way, but, like, the justification that they made for this being a society that went back to prehistoric times was that they were using archaeological evidence that was relevant to the 19th century. And unfortunately, a lot of the information that we gathered post the 40s has proven a lot of that information wrong. Proves they weren't around for that long, but it is also it's this example frozen in amber of the way that people saw the world at that time. It's also, so, like, that's the reason why the Masons can count for oddities if you wanted to see it that way. It's the same way you can reason carnivals can fit into oddities, is because they were using the most expensive and the bleeding edge newest engineering feats that they had at the height of, like, the carnival golden age, is what they call the 1890s.
Would that also include dime museums as, like, a way of showing science off to the public?
Yes, very much. Oftentimes people would have these enormous collections. I mean, museums weren't an institution until pretty recently. They were private collections. They were club collections. That was usually the closest you would get to a museum would be either, like, well, I mean, national museums was probably the first thing that we can get to for if we're looking at the modern definition of a museum. But I'm pretty sure we can probably trace this directly back to Napoleon. Thanks, Napoleon.
God damn it, Napoleon.
Ran over to Egypt in, like, the 1790s, sacked the place, stole all their shit, put it in a museum, and said, this is France's now.
No, put the mummies back!
No, he wants to eat them.
No.
Yum, 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 yum,
no, 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 no.
Grind them up, put them into paint.
No! Don't paint with people!
Oh, they couldn't help themselves, they were drawn to it.
I mean, I understand the affinity, but Jesus.
I did also want to bring up the fact that, like, another reason why oddities exist is because there wasn't really a sharp dividing line between amateur and professional for a really long time. colleges were the best way for poor but mostly middle class people to have access to funds that they could use to pay for experiments and experiment equipment. But this was mostly like, this was mostly something that aristocrats did. And it's like, where was I going with this thought?
Aristocrats' private collections museums?
Aristocrats' private collections museums. This is why dime museums were like the only way that people could be able to see certain animals. Like, yeah, there were zoos at the time, but they weren't great, and a lot of animals died. So you want to see a giraffe? Well, we had one last month, but she's dead. So we stuffed her. And that's the story of Daisy the giraffe, who was brought to France during the Napoleonic times. She had a little coat to keep her warm on the walk up from Marseille. Yeah, which didn't last. That was pre-Napoleon. No, it was after Napoleon. I'm sitting here mummering to myself. This is the plight of humanity's people. We just sit there muttering to ourselves.
Sitting there muttering to yourself about Napoleon probably puts you square in Victor Hugo's shoes.
I mean, listen. Thank you. All I need to do is start a riot. Goals are done.
Give it time.
Thank you. So dime museums. Dime museums were cheap ways that you could see cool stuff. Carnivals, same thing. P.T. Barnum was most well known for like really jumping back and forth over the line between like huckster and scientific, because he did want people to know that he was paying experts, and he did want people to know that like he had gone to great extent to find shit. But on the other hand, he also had no problem with like making fake shit. Like the Fiji mermaid is his most famous slapped together oddity that he didn't manufacture it. I can explain a little bit about the Fiji. No, I don't. I'm not going to explain the Fiji mermaid.
I think you might have to, because like...
No. Oh, fine.
Believe me, we can absolutely double up on Fiji mermaid episodes.
So the Fiji mermaid was actually a monkey sewn to a fish. And they're actually... it's monkey sewn to a fish. They're really, really common sideshow gaffes. They have been common sideshow gaffes for thousands of years. But they were not well known outside of the Pacific region, because on the Atlantic coast, there's not a lot of monkeys.
Oh.
P.T. Barnum, so like apparently this thing made it all the way to the East Coast. I think that P.T. Barnum was actually in California looking for something new. And he like met a Polynesian fisherman who was like, what, you want this? Really? You're going to freak out about it? Fine, $5, whatever. Take it off my hands. But he'd never seen it before, and he also knew, like, he could whip up a huge fuss over it. So he brought it back to New York, and he said, you know, I found a real mermaid! They're in the Pacific! You'll never guess what they actually look like! And he put it on display, and people were, like, supposedly fainting. It was so ugly, because you expect this beautiful siren combing her hair, and instead it's a dead monkey sewn to a fish. And if you look at, like, Japanese mythology, that is much more in line with the way that they picture half-human, half-fish creatures. So, again, this was something that was really old in that entire portion of, like, that entire coastal region of the world, but it was totally new elsewhere.
That is a wild ride.
So it's kind of like, again, straddling this line between huckster, it's not a real mermaid, but science, it is something that's been around for a really long time. And it is something that, I mean, it is art, it is craft.
It's educational, just not in the way you thought it would be.
It is. It is. Not in the way you thought it would be. But I also like dime museums and stuff that are fake but still old is one thing. But we also want to, like, again, oddities covers a whole bunch of stuff. So we can look at Fiji mermaids, but we can also look at science glass, which is the reason why I had to delete literally like 3 or 4 paragraphs from my notes.
You didn't have to.
I did have to. I needed to delete them.
We'll just have you come back on again and go through them again.
And I will. So now you see why I had to delete them.
Creating a scarcity.
Yes. P.T. Barnum taught me that. But going back to what I was saying before about this being like largely an aristocratic occupation, science and medicine, before there was industrialization, before there was standardization, nobody knew what was going to be good for burning certain chemicals or for putting them in water or for just doing experiments on them, and also, like, there's not, like, the only way that you can do it is to have somebody hand blow a gigantic beaker. So, one of the things that you have in Oddities is all of these beautiful, one-of-a-kind pieces of scientific glass. The most nerve-wracking, but technically genius piece that I've seen was a beaker that was perfectly round except for the spout, and it was almost the size of my entire torso.
Holy shit.
We don't know what the fuck it was for.
Science!
Science! Completely hand-blown glass. This is a bubble. I'm looking around, the size of an air conditioner, basically.
That is crazy.
Where do you put that in a shop? How do you hang that? How do you store it?
Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Oh,
How do you do it?
how do you display this priceless artifact?
I think that's the reason why we got it so cheap. We eventually hung it from the ceiling.
There you go. Pinata.
Yeah. But this, so that's, like, that's one of the reasons why they're really popular. Scientific glass specifically is because, like, a lot of them are completely unique. A lot of them are entirely one of a kind. Sometimes that's because other examples broke, and sometimes it's because they were specially made to order for one experiment.
Oh, that must create a lot of fun variety.
Yeah. Somebody hands you a piece of glass and you're like, "What is it?" And you're like, "Science glass." And you throw it into the corner that you've designated science glass. But what was it for? Science glass.
Another smash. No, the history.
There's no provenance. Fuck your history. It's just science glass. So, I mean, this was kind of like the age of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, where, like, if you had enough books and you could quote enough authors that were well known within different circles, you were an expert. Congratulations, you don't need a doctorate.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Imagine the time and money saved.
I know. I know.
New plan. We make a time machine, go back to the early 1800s, and we're all instantly doctors.
I know. But the problem with that is that, like, we don't have any capital to, like, spend on any of research, so we would just be walking around town being like, "I'm an expert. These are the books that I read. Come back. I can tell you about the books." So that's why people went to college, so that the college could pay for their work. And if you were Jonathan Strange, then you just made the government do it because you had connections.
Also, you were a wizard.
Also, you were a wizard, but he could work for chemists as well.
Alchemy?
Alchemy. Yes, we can talk about alchemy. I got a whole book on alchemy. It's great. I love alchemy.
Hell yeah.
Alchemy is great. Alchemy is chemistry. Alchemy was literally the official definition for the science of the material, the building blocks of the universe, until people wanted to move away from the implications that were left behind by the medievalists. But the medievalists, again, like, they thought that, if you put a mouse in a bullet wound that it would heal, but they didn't know what they were doing. Like, they didn't have much.
Wait,
What?
sorry. Quick rewind.
Yes.
If you put a mouse
Yes.
in a bullet wound.
Yes. No evidence if that's real or not. That was an example that Victor Hugo put into The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Oh, okay. You want a real example? All right. All right. Hold on. Hold on. I got a book in
No,
front of me.
I'm still reeling. I do not mistake me. I am not doubting Victor Hugo's research.
I mean, the problem with Victor Hugo's research is that he had access to materials that might have fallen apart in the past 200 years. So we can't tell if he made anything up or not. Also, he was one of the French Romantics, and they were like, that was their whole deal, was making shit up.
Such as putting mice in bullet.
Right. But again, this could have been something that an alchemist wrote down, because a lot of it was like half metaphor, it was half poetry, half science. It was philosophy, it was art. They were trying to piece together a way to look at the world that wouldn't kill people, and they had no way of doing that. And again, I mentioned that you could go to a college and have somebody pay for your education, first of all, but second of all, and most importantly, your research. And before there were colleges, and the first college was built in the medieval period in Paris, which is why it was called the City of Lights, was not just because they had the first real streetlight system, but also because they had the first university and they were illuminating their manuscripts there. Haha. But so before those, you only had the church, and that was it. The church held all of the books. The church chose which books were people were allowed to read and which were supposed to stay in the church. And the church also let you test to see which ones were sinful or deadly or neither.
Sorry, test which books are sinful or deadly?
Sorry. Test to see which theories that were written down in those books were deadly or sinful.
Okay.
Right.
Because I'm just going to write sinful, deadly books underneath put mouse in bullet wound.
Right.
Because I might have a novel outline here.
I mean, listen, that's just the name of the rose, and that was already written for you. You could check it out. I honestly thought it was really boring. There wasn't enough history of science in it. If they had just stuck with that, I would have been all over it. But no, they had to get into theology. I don't care what the church found heretical. I care who made the first pair of glasses.
Benjamin Franklin.
No! They've been around longer than that, Ken!
He invented lightning.
He didn't invent lightning! I will fight Benjamin Franklin with my own two hands and I will win because he's been dead for 200 years.
And I would sell tickets.
But is it an oddity? Or
Yes.
it. Okay. But alchemy was a science. Alchemy was a real science. They didn't know what they were doing, but you don't. If you can't figure out what you're doing unless you make mistakes. But the problem is that because it was funded by the church, because people didn't know what the fuck they were doing, and because there was absolutely no method to quality control the books that were being published post the Gutenberg press, they could say whatever the fuck they wanted. Like they could. The church ones, obviously, you need to stay like religious-y, but that's not what I don't mean. Like they could say whatever the fuck they wanted, and there was a monk somewhere being like, "Huh, tits." I mean, you could say that you put a mouse in a bullet hole and it fucking heals up. It's fine, you know. You could say there's this magical gold, silver liquid, and you can drink it and you'll live forever, and it's not sinful, so the church isn't going to stop you. And there's not a board checking to see if your science is good. So publish it and sell it to a peasant. So alchemy is confusing and it's a mess, and people, famous alchemists, rose to prominence because they wrote books that didn't kill people.
So it was a kind of trial by fire for the author, but the fire was the populace?
Yes.
And sometimes they died.
Yes.
Oops.
Yes. Well, basically what I'm saying instead is like it's a little bit more of a practical social Darwin thing. I don't want to say social Darwin, but you know what I mean. Like, if Grandmama has this book that she says cures all of her illnesses and she's crazy, you don't keep the book. If Grandmama has a book that she says keeps all of her, like, has been keeping her young and she lives to be 102 and it's 1630, you keep that book.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And so the books that survived, I mean, like, those books are rare. If you have an alchemical text, it's an oddity. It's also a medical antique, but it's kind of a cult too. And especially because, like, the stars and planets were so important, it's because they didn't know what the fuck they were doing with any of these chemicals, and it's because they thought that alcohol was magic.
I mean, does it not feel magic? I legit wouldn't know.
So what else? Dime museums and alchemy. Alchemy is real. This is also why, like, you can see New Age stuff at an oddity store. I personally wouldn't carry it, as I mentioned in like the Haunted Antiques episode. New Age occult stuff, it can get really homemade. Homemade stuff doesn't tend to be sealed properly, and it can fall apart much faster, and it's very difficult to date.
Hard to prove provenance on whether or not it came out of someone's Etsy shop last week.
Exactly. Also, like, sometimes stuff is like ultra fake and it's still New Age. Vampire hunting kits were the bane of our existence because people would just put like a piece of wood into a last rites kit and be like, it's a vampire killing kit. And we'd be like, it's a last rites kit. And you put a pencil in it and said it was a stake.
Oh my god. Oh my god. I want to be angry, but I cannot. because that is more effort than was put into the vampire hunting kits they were selling at Ren Faire last year.
Oh god, what did they sell?
See, I thought this was going to be a tale of someone trying to bring one of those in and be like, no, absolutely, authentic, 13th century, what do you mean Pyrex?
13th century? That's not even like a well-known story at that point. If they were like, it's Victorian, I'd be like, well, there was a craze at that point, okay.
Everyone was wacky for vampires.
They were!
Just ask Mercy Brown.
I'm glad, poor Mercy Brown.
I mean, she was dead by the time they staked her for vampirism, so like, she's probably fine.
I mean, she was 7 and dead. That's sad.
No, she was like a teenager.
Fine, it's not sad anymore. She could have been moody. Just being a gripey little goth all over the place, and then they were like, well, you know, that kid did have, you know, she did talk about, she was kind of sad all the time. Maybe she's a vampire now.
Finally, her dream achieved.
Oh.
For those of us listening who aren't in the know, Mercy Brown was a young woman in 1890s Rhode Island who died of tuberculosis, and then because her brother also got tuberculosis, they assumed she was a vampire and rising from the grave at night to suck the life out of him. So they dug her up and burned her heart on a pyre and then made her brother drink the ashes.
And that did not cure him.
No, funnily enough, he still had tuberculosis.
Yep. If anyone wants to know how people could think that a mouse could cure a bullet wound...
To their credit, they tried. No, they tried something. They had nothing, and they tried something.
Exactly.
They were doing their best.
I know, but that's a much more succinct point that I've been kind of sputtering over for the past 30 minutes. Holy shit. I wanted to bring this back to, like, how oddities became an industry.
Ooh, yes, please.
And as always, we can blame the Victorians.
And their sickening whimsy.
And their sickening whimsy. So, as you and Dee have kind of mentioned, Romanticism was still kind of an edgy literary movement at the 1890s, but it was also, like, getting kind of old, so it was institutionalized. It was, like, edgy, but it was something cool that you could bring up around your mom, and she'd be like, oh dear, you're so lively. So, people were really fascinated by nature, and until Darwin, they were still cool with science. So they wanted to be up to date on science. They wanted to be able to have the same kind of like aristocratic air of learning and knowledge about them. So they would have little scientific things that you could have around your house. They would have little curiosities. They would have biology samples. They would have prisms were actually really popular. So one of the issues that you have in the oddities industry is trying to figure out if you are looking at something that was scientific and a teaching model, most likely, or if you were looking at basically a parlor game that somebody would have in their house and bring out for parties.
Martha, watch me refract this light.
Right. So exactly. Was this piece used by somebody who was doing a physics experiment? And if they were doing a physics experiment, was it in their house or was it in a university? And if you are buying it, it's not really that important. But if you're selling it, you fuck gotta know what the fuck it is. If you're buying it, it's probably all the same age, so it's not that big of a deal. But you should know what you're selling, and you shouldn't be misleading people. So it's really important to know. It's pretty simple. Stuff that was being used by professionals wasn't pretty.
Oh.
It wasn't. So one of my favorite examples is that we had two Bouchaine skulls, and a Bouchaine skull is a skull that has been taken apart by the sutures to show every bone in the skull. There are 40 bones in the skull.
Oh, shit.
Yes. We had two. We had an actual antique that was used in schools to teach doctors, and we had an artistic rendering that was actually made by a friend of the store. Everybody thought that the artistic piece was the actual piece, and I didn't blame them. Like, it was made out of very highly polished brass, it was pretty, it had little floral decorations on it, whereas the scientific one that was actually from a college looked like somebody had kind of stuck this thing onto a wire, like a broken coat hanger.
Because they did.
Yep, they probably did. It was mass produced. It was boring to look at. It wasn't meant to inspire people.
There's no time for beauty. We have science to do.
Basically. Yeah, people would get excited. Not just about, like, I mean, there's cool stuff out there, right? Like, you find a cool shell, you pick up the cool shell. It's the first time anybody in your town has seen a cool shell. Congratulations, they're all freaking out about the cool shell. And if you're the first person in England to bring that cool shell to England, the shell's named after you now. And so people were, like, not just all about the cool shells, but they were also all about these stories, these romantic stories about people going to far-off countries and coming back and winning fame because they found a cool shell.
The coolest shell.
It's spiny. And colorful. What else do you want to know?
If I want to get into the Oddities game now, how much money am I going to lose?
That depends on exactly what your interests are, and I also strongly recommend that you pick an interest right now.
Ah, oh, fuck.
Do it. What are you interested in? What are you interested in?
Skulls!
Okay, good.
I fucking love skulls!
Okay, $1,000, flat.
No, my money!
Wait, what kind of skull?
I feel like person skull would get into some weird legal area.
Yeah.
So let's say animal skull.
Okay. Well, those can range. They're actually pretty easy to find because there are a lot of reasons why animals die. Natural causes, farmers trying to get rid of them for a variety of reasons, not just for domestic, like, meat purposes, but also because you're trying to get rid of pests that are in your farm. So yeah, animal skulls, pretty easy to get a hold of. Medical surplus is also pretty easy to get a hold of. But again, as I mentioned, there is a really big variety in them. Needles are really easy to get a hold of. Most people do remove the sharps because obvious. And some of them are actually really cool to look at. Like, one of the interesting things about needles in particular is that before plastics, they weren't disposable, so you would just take the plunger out and clean it, like, manually.
Oh!
So in order to make sure that you had the correct plunger to the correct needle, you would sometimes have little designs or colors on them so that they would match up properly.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That is terrifying from a patient perspective, but fun from a collector perspective.
Exactly! There's medical antiques, there's funeral antiques. A lot of it is entirely dependent on age, but other things can factor in, like materials. If you wanted a small syringe, very plentiful from pre-germ theory, that's going to be cost more than something post-germ theory.
Really?
Right. Because history. Because it is a physical, tangible example of something that we don't believe in anymore. Liston knives are actually an example that I wrote down. Liston knives were a type of scalpel. You would use them on patients. They were supposed to be very lightweight and sharp, so they were supposed to hurt less than a big, blunt, heavy knife. Imagine that. But because they were invented in the 1870s, I think, it managed to land smack dab in the middle of the debate between whether germ theory should be widespread or if it should depend on the doctor. So it went really quickly from being made out of whatever the fuck, plastic, cloth, wood. I've seen a couple of Bakelite handles. Those are really cool. To all metal all the time.
Aha, because I feel like I don't want my doctor digging into me with a cloth-handled scalpel.
Are you sure?
I have concerns about pathogens.
But now you
I'm
do.
I'm one of those wacky germ theory types.
I know, but now you do. They didn't know that at the time, but that's one of the reasons why
no
this is.
Idea. No idea. Had miasma theory. Who needs germs?
I mean, I feel like miasma theory is a really good precursor to germs. Like, if you don't have anything else, then miasma theory is the closest one.
If you don't know germs are real, miasma theory makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. It's better than thinking the poles, like, magnetic poles make you sick.
Wait, they don't?
Get out. Get out with your magnet earth bullshit. Get out. I swear to God, Mesmer died for a reason. Mesmer and his theories.
Do you not find them mesmerizing?
Shut up. Did you think that was funny? These and your Mesmer jokes. Oh, Orientalism was also something that I wanted to bring up. Can't talk about oddities without bringing up Orientalism, because archaeology was also a science that was being invented, and I'm going to just put the whole 19th century as the reason for archaeology and anthropology to have been invented.
All right.
Yes, again, we can blame Napoleon for this. He went down to Egypt and he was like,
God damn it. Fucking asshole every time.
Fuck you, Napoleon. I could talk so much shit on Napoleon.
Someday, a Napoleon episode.
Yes, fuck that short little man who is actually average sized. Archaeology. So he went down to Egypt and he was like sick. And he spent a whole bunch of money to have a whole bunch of French people go over and like look at the old drawings and writings that were all over the place. And eventually they managed to yada yada Rosetta Stone. They created a comprehensive cipher to translate what almost everything said. And it took them years. And obviously we're still finding things that we need to translate, and we're finding other languages that need to be translated. But that's not the point. The point is that people were coming back from Egypt, and also continental tours were getting really easy. Like, train tracks were being laid all across Europe, so it was all of a sudden really easy to go to Rome, or to Greece, to Athens you could go. And Byron went first, obviously, and he wrote about it extensively. And then I think it was actually Gerard de Nerval who was next, or maybe that's just, you know, me showing my Francophile side. Sorry, but the poets went down and they were like, oh, art, it's so beautiful, there's so much, they're all dead, it's sad, I'm romantic. And so people followed them, and there were continental tours, and these things were in museums, and there were so many books being written. There was literally there was a science being invented, and one of the things Edward Said said in his book Orientalism was that they knew that they were not just inventing a science, but that there was a limited amount of work that they could do. And so they were doing this as fast as possible, and they were also building this mythos around themselves as fast as possible. So you are a Victorian, you are hearing people talking about how they have discovered a whole new civilization that doesn't exist anymore. It is completely different to anything that you know right now. It's in all of the magazines, it's in all of the museums, what few exist. And it was incredible. Like, there were people writing fiction stories about it, so everybody got into a train, basically. There was this mass, and decades long, generations traveled to both Egypt and to Mediterranean, southern European countries, and they wanted to go see these ruins, and they wanted to go see what everybody was talking about. And they picked stuff up out of the ruins. And they walked away with it.
No! 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 Take only pictures, leave only footprints! What are you doing?
What pictures, Ken?
Yes, but...
What pictures, Ken?
Take out your charcoal and make a sketch.
And people did. That was something else that, like, I know you know, because, like, again, English romantics were doing this too. People were like, oh, I went to Athens and I drew the Colosseum that's in Rome, but you know what I mean. They were doing that. That was a really popular thing. That was in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
It was.
It was. Okay, I don't need to just, like, wave my hand and be like, oh, you know, a poet said it. It was in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
Official book of the podcast.
Official book of the podcast. People were picking stuff up. People were drawing things. And again, it was science for some people. So, a lot of texts were... Fuck, I'm losing my train of thought. Ken, quick, help!
Napoleon invented archaeology.
He basically did. I mean, he was one of the contributing forces to archaeology. But it's another example of there being, like, stuff...
Wait, Orientalism? Is that anything?
Yeah, Orientalism was the, like, legitimate field of research that, like, that was what they were calling any non-Western archaeology up until somebody said that maybe not. It's actually pretty recent. I think it only stopped in like the 1960s, but I think there is actually a chapter about that in Orientalism by Edward Said. When different universities started to switch over from Orientalism to breaking it up into much more specific categories of learning. So it wasn't just Orientalism. You could study like archaeology of the Near East, archaeology of Japan, archaeology of China, Egypt, ancient Nile. But... Oh, hi. Yeah, I actually wrote a note that, like, if you didn't pick it up, or, like, you didn't know what you were looking for when you were just going through the ruins and looking at pebbles, it's probably really likely that somebody in the village was going to sell you something cool. I can say this from, like, as somebody with family on an island where there are Greek baths and Roman ruins, they're out there. There's people who are like, I found a cool thing, you want it? Sell it to you. How much money you got? Oh, that's not enough. Okay, I'll wait for somebody else. Like, they're out there. I also have a friend who was doing a research paper on the effect of like this kind of ancient Greek enthusiasm on modern infrastructure, and there was this town in Greece that found an old aqueduct and they just like quietly destroyed it so that the archaeologists wouldn't come. They had a really good reason though. They were like, we need a new water plant. We can't wait for you to get all of this shit out of our earth.
That's fair.
It is.
I would honestly would have taken fuck those tourists as a justification.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't agree with it, but I would understand it.
Yeah. So to bring it all back, what is an oddity?
Who are Oddity?
Who are oddity? And an oddity is everywhere. Put out your hands, feel the earth, feel the air. That's an oddity.
Oh my God.
It is.
I can't even hold music.
A light catcher that you put in your window is, like, as we mentioned before, actually an oddity. It has its roots in the real Victorian oddities industry. Wind chimes are literally an oddity. They come from Orientalism, they come from this old archaeological tradition. So, what isn't an oddity? And as we discussed before, I usually put it down to, like, whatever D doesn't, like, if D has trouble recognizing it, just call me up and I'll be like, I can figure it out. I don't know what a pearl tastes like, but I did get really mad that one time you guys went to Brimfield and you saw an Ozu and you passed it by.
One time.
It was an Ozu, my guy.
Still don't know what an Ozu is.
It's a papier-mâché anatomical model. They're really well made. That's why they're cool. And they also get broken because they're papier-mâché, so to see one intact is neat. But that am oddities.
So, oddity is medicine or science, probably from a while back. Blame the Victorians.
Blame the Victorians.
And usually creeps out your normcore friends.
Exactly. If grandma won't hold it, it's probably an oddity. But grandma's cool sometimes.
Sometimes grandma's cool.
And I actually do have sources for this because, like, despite the way I was talking for this episode, I did try to do some research. I have Orientalism by Edward Said, as I mentioned earlier, Distilling Knowledge, Alchemy, Chemistry, and the Scientific Revolution
Hell yeah.
by Bruce T. Moran, which is a really good book. I very highly recommend it. And I also took a couple of bits from Religion in Ancient Egypt, which was edited by Byron E. Schaefer, and the authors are John Baines, Leonard H. Lesko, and David P. Silverman.
All right, cool.
Yeah!
Well, thank you for coming, Olivia, and telling us all about oddities.
Yeah! Thank you for having me.
Do you have anything you want to plug? Perhaps a book of your own?
I am actually in the process of having a book published. It's called Lord of Thundertown. And you can see updates on Tumblr or on Twitter. My user handle is Obfuscate. On Tumblr, it's a zero for the O. But on Twitter, nobody had the original Obfuscate, so I took it with a zero. With an O, I mean. And the U is a V for both of them.
All right.
Yeah.
So that's Lord of Thundertown.
Lord of Thundertown, due to be published in December. From Nine Star Press. Check them out. Got a lot of good books.
If you would like to follow Antiques Freaks on social media, you can find us on Twitter at antiques_freaks, on Tumblr, antiquesfreaks.tumblr.com, or on Facebook, facebook.com/antiquesfreaks. And there you can also find our fan group, Antiques Freaks Friends. For deleted scenes and to join the Random Vintage Postcard of the Month Club, you can check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks. Special shout out to our current patrons, Angela, Anjali, Charles, Endless Night Arts, Jared, Judy, Juha, Casey, Kevin, Lisa, Matt, Monica, Olivia, Paris, Patrick, Priscilla, Sam, Sarita, Talia, and Zane. Thank you all for supporting the podcast and making it possible. And thank you to everyone for listening. Bye.